You are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, the station that loves you, with Felicia and Marshall.
Hey, Felicia, how's it going?
Good.
Yeah.
And we're just kind of ending Rhiannon Giddens. Always nice to come in after the Homegrown Garden Island Bluegrass Show.
These guys are awesome.
They're awesome. And yeah. I think that was Joe singing again. I can't remember what the name of the band is today. What's the name of the band today? Oh, even y'all can't remember.
No, I don't.
Y'all forgot. Well, really talented. We got all kinds of talented people here at Kauai Community Radio, all volunteer station. And we're happy to be in here.
Yeah, we are. I'm happy to be here. So, Felicia, what is going on? What's going on around the island?
Well, today we've got a whole lot of this and that on different types of topics, and then I'll just let the listener know we are having some phone line problems, and if the phone comes back up, then we'll get our callers. But and the number is 826-7771. But otherwise, lots of things to talk about, and Kauai Soapbox is made possible by listeners like you, in partnership with Kauai Stores and Pono Pies.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
The Kauai Store is located in Kapa'a on the highway in front of Kostilas. The store has authentic Kauai products including clothing, snacks, art, coffee, crafts, and more. We even have local food samples. The Kauai Store products are also available online at thekauaistore.com.
Pono Pies, dedicated to restoring breadfruit as a major food crop in Hawaii. Gluten, dairy, and GMO-free. Delicious Pono Pies, available at health food stores throughout Hawaii. PonoPies.com, 808-283-3718.
Aloha, listeners of KKCR. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, your daily grassroots global news hour, urging you to support Kauai Community Radio. KKCR has been broadcasting from their jungle shack and building community in the island since 1997. Please show your love for KKCR by making an investment in the station that loves you. Your support at any level will pay dividends all year long and ensure the continued success of Kauai Community Radio. From our family at Democracy Now! To your ohana in the center of the Pacific, mahalo for your support. It really does make a difference.
Yes, mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. And that was Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Really does some awesome programming.
You know what, honestly, Felicia, I wish I could listen.
Because you're so busy, and then...
Yeah. It's just not a good time for me to be listening to the radio. So I hear wonderful things. Yeah.
Yep.
Have you heard it lately?
From 11 to 12? I have heard it, and what I also do sometimes, because it keeps me up to speed on what's going on in the world, is I can just go to democracynow.org.
Oh, I bet they have a podcast, too.
Well, they have a video cast.
Oh.
So, okay. You know, you could sit there and watch it.
Oh, right on.
So,
There's just such competition, you know, for my attention.
Oh, of course.
There's information coming from all sides, and there's so much of it.
There is so many things that's going on. But, like, we have many different things going on the island. And we'll see if the phones start working, but I was expecting a call from Beth Tokioka from Kauai Island Utility Cooperative. I had a number of questions and things from different listeners. People often share with us what they're concerned about. And so I always, whenever I can, I speak to the primary source and see if that they want to come in and or call in and talk about it. And one thing, just to address a little bit of that, is every year they do an annual meeting, and it's pretty easy to go to, and they give you things like light bulbs and big bags of rice.
You're talking about KIUC now.
The Quiet Island Utility Cooperative. Because mm-hmm. that was my call that is going to come in, or was going to come in, but I figure I would still give them a little bit of the coverage that I was going to get from a call-in.
Yeah, sure. I just tried the phones, and you just get a busy signal. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, call, phones are not working right now, but, well, what's going on with KIUC? What's
well, one thing that is coming up, which is Thursday, July 27th, so I think that's 2 weeks from this Thursday.
Okay.
They have their annual meeting. And normally it's at the Performing Arts Center, but I guess that's under construction, so it will be in the Kauai War Memorial Convention Hall. And typically they have a big slideshow, a big PowerPoint presentation of what's coming up and what they've been doing. And, you know, there's a lot of things coming up. And so among them is they've done these Tesla batteries.
Right.
This year. And
did you go down to see them?
I was taking a cinema class that weekend that the state put on. It was a really good film industry class. They were kind of teaching people who are doing film work, and so I couldn't make it. I had that overlap.
Right.
But they did have a big blessing of the one in the Kapaia area,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of just around Hanama'ulu, north of Lihue. But one of the questions that I had asked Beth, and that they will cover at the KIUC meeting, this big meeting, annual meeting, is like, you know, people get concerned about why are we taking agriculture land? There's about 200 acres that I believe is going to be coming up, and they're going to put that's on the south side,
mm-hmm.
and put a solar farm on it. And the Department of Agriculture has considered farming solar on ag land as ag. Because it's, you know, you could be growing sugar to make or corn or something like that to make fuel, but they're growing sunlight, so
that's considered. No, they're not growing. So I mean,
they're harvesting.
I'm not doubting that.
Harvesting sunlight.
Yeah.
Harvesting sunlight.
Okay, maybe that's how they look at it, but I do not see that as agriculture. No, that's you know, power generation.
It's power generation, or
catchment, really. Sunlight catchment. That is not about growing anything. Certainly, it's not about the soil. Any agriculture that doesn't involve... Well, okay, so we got hydroponics, but they're putting minerals in there. I don't know. No.
Well, so anyway, that is what is happening, and that does happen. And so far now we have that they're called solar farms. So there are, I think... at least four. There's a big one in Ele'ele. There's a big one in Anahola. There's one in Kapa'a near the roundabout. And then there's going to be this new one down there where, you know, the goal is to be 100% renewable.
Right.
And so concern has been, well, how come they're using that, you know, horse pasture is what some of the land was. You know, so some people are a little frustrated about that.
Is that considered agriculture, raising horses?
Yes.
Okay.
Why not?
Well, what's, I mean, we're not eating horse meat, clearly.
But, horses, you know, livestock is agriculture use, pasture land, you know, it's pasture land. So, okay, pasture land. I mean, I'm sure they don't have a 200-acre horse pasture here. They could. That would be a normal horse pasture in the southwest. But anyway, so they're going to put this field there. And I did ask, you know, how come we can't put this on buildings, or why can't we put it, you know, over parking lots? And those are kind of questions that can be asked at this meeting. But when they're using these Tesla batteries, they've got these super efficient methods of being able to store the energy, and they need to put it all together. It's sort of like a factor of scale. So there's that going there, and they are grazing sheep in the solar fields, and that's the mowing machines.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. I think there's, you know, a number of different elements. What I was going to ask about, so I was going to save it for the air, but the water battery discussion, there is the thought of putting a water battery, which means pumping water between two reservoirs. So right now on a sunny day, we use all that we produce. And so we don't need any more, right? You just have this sunshine that's just kind of not being really utilized. So it's how do we save it? So we've got these Tesla batteries that we're holding it in so they could use it at night. Then another thing that we're doing is when they're thinking about the water battery in the summertime, I mean the sunshine, they pump the water up the top of the hill and hold it in the upper reservoir, and then when the sun goes down, as the water is needed, I mean as the power is needed, it goes through a hydro plant, a simple hydro thing, so it creates a little power on the way down.
Right, so yeah, a very simple engineering solution to the problem of storing energy from peak production time to peak demand time.
Right, and I think the idea behind a water storage battery, Carol Bain was the one who is really deeply behind it. She's definitely one of our KKCR friends. She's now one of our guardian angels. She has left us this past year and transitioned out of this life. But she was pushing this a lot. Some of the issues are, do we put it in a reservoir that is susceptible to, evaporation, or do we put it between like two big tanks, right? But then you have to build the two big tanks.
Right.
And so to move the water around. So there's a couple different opportunities of how that's done, but then you don't require the batteries, and batteries typically have lithium or something like that in there that is still environmentally impactful, and who knows how long they last.
Right. Right. Well, I can't wait to see this new generation of batteries. Hopefully that will begin to provide a more sophisticated technological solution, or at least a better solution than what we have now. But yeah, that sounds promising. Yeah,
well, and almost any kind of energy generation is going to have an impact. I had a discussion with some people last night about the biomass facility. And, I've been in there and I've looked at it. And, from my limited knowledge base, you can't smell it. You don't hear it. It seems visibly very clean, the amount of water that's moving through it. I was really surprised at how well and smoothly it ran, and it's harvesting. I love the way albizia trees look, but that is considered somewhat of an invasive. So it's like, when you eat the invasives or, burn the albizia.
Yeah, and unless they're intentionally doing it in a way where they're not going to grow back, they're going to grow back. So
they're going to grow back. They are, I think, some of the goals in some of these places, if they'd actually be taken out and then replaced with a different type of tree that is maybe less thirsty or less invasive, but
still for biomass.
For biomass. Yeah. And so right now that system is working pretty well. In fact, I happen to be looking at what they call their annual fuel mix disclosure. They put out a magazine called Currents Magazine, and so we can see what goes on there. And, biomass in 2012, there was none of that. They really didn't start producing until 2015. And so in 2015, they had, 5,700,000 kilowatts were generated. So if you think of that, 5.7, and then 2016, it went up by almost a factor of 10. They had 51 million. So that has really grown, massively. And then the fossil fuels amount in 2012 was 406 million kilowatts came from fossil fuels. And in 2016, that had dropped to 291 million. So that's over a 25% drop. And, while I've been on this program, we'd say, 95% of our energy is coming from fuel from somewhere else and how dependent that is. So we're seeing a really big difference on that. And hydro has stayed pretty steady. It was 40,587 40,587,000 kilowatt hours, and now it's like down to 35,700. So it's dropped a little bit. I think that is because of the viability of holding the water in one of the dams. But photovoltaic has gone from 5 million to almost 79 million kilowatt hours. So that's a huge jump. So we're really seeing a lot of hitting that goal of moving away from being dependent on imported fuels. And when you look at the total amount of generation, it really hasn't gone up very much. It's gone up 6 million kilowatt hours. So that is not even 1%. And so our population has grown. It means we're being more efficient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to see more progress in that direction as well, bring down the demand overall. I think that would just be healthy for us in terms of lifestyle.
Yeah, and then when we have the point source on people's houses, you know, that's a really great mix too. So that percentage, biomass is 11%, photovoltaic is 12%, fossil fuels is still 64%. That's for 2016, but I think we're going to see that continuously dropping. So that means this year, 36% of our power was generated by things right here on renewable resources. So that's a big jump.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah. So that's good. So,
Wait, you know what I wanted to mention about KIUC? Because you said you're going to bring them up. I just got a bill that they include this little storm sense pamphlet. Did you see that?
Uh-uh.
Yeah, it's got all kinds of hurricane preparation information in it. It's awesome.
And do they have anything in there particularly about power, how to manage your power?
I didn't digest it.
You didn't see
it
all
yet.
That all no. That much?
Oh, wait. Yeah, power lines and utility poles. Should I read it?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, yeah.
When lines from utility poles are on the ground, assume they are dangerous. Don't touch them. If someone is touching a line, don't try to rescue them yourself and risk becoming a victim. Get help immediately by calling 911 or KIUC's emergency line at 246-8200. Beware, a fence or guardrail can be energized for 1,000 yards if it is touching a downed power line. Well, that's scary.
Yeah, or even if it's touching water, you don't want to, you know, be walking in, like if you see marshy, big puddled water, you don't want to step in that.
Right. If a power line falls on your car while you are in it, wait for help if possible. If you must get out, jump free of the car so your body clears the vehicle before touching the ground. All right. And there's plenty more in here. Using a generator after a hurricane, a preparation checklist, survival kit before a hurricane, stay informed during a hurricane.
What does it say about a generator? I was just listening to some ads on the radio about good prices on generators. That's something that really does matter.
I remember seeing a video clip from Postaniki where people had somehow painted on their rooftop really big for the view of helicopters, send generators. Does that make sense in terms of the need that existed at that time?
Yeah, and if I could give a shout out to timeshare owners.
Yeah.
At the time I had a surf shop,
mm-hmm.
and we had timeshare owners without any kind of compulsion to ask for it.
Mm-hmm.
They would send really nice boxes, gifts to the shop saying, share this out with whoever might need it.
Mm.
We had probably 7 or 8 different timeshare owners choose to send generators.
Oh, but really?
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
We had all kinds of gifting from, you know, our part-time community.
You know, I think they love Kauai. I think they love the community for the most part. Yeah, I've heard from timeshare owners that they're stoked on the place. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and for whatever anybody might think, they feel like part-time residents. So often they are super, super helpful. They were our first visitors back, and they came ready to work.
Yeah.
Wanting to work, cleaning up.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Do you still want to be?
Yeah, I want to hear about the generator.
Using a generator. Before operating a generator, be sure your home is not connected to KIU system where electric lines feed into the meter. Turn off the main breaker to your home before operating a generator. If your generator is being used to power an individual appliance or a piece of equipment, make sure it is connected directly to your generator. This keeps the power safely isolated from any other wiring in your building or beyond. Have a qualified electrician install a special switch so power is properly supplied to the house without endangering family, neighbors, or utility workers in the area. Follow the instruction manual to properly ground the generator. Make sure its location is properly ventilated because of the danger of fumes and overheating. And minimize the noise impact as much as possible. Store reserve fuel in a safe place away from the generator. Yeah, that's interesting. Usually I think of emergency use of a generator as sort of like plugging in this or that, you know, directly to the generator, but you can hook up your generator to your entire house.
Yeah. Which is, you know, what is native to me, because I have definitely lived in all solar houses.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the whole system is designed that if you needed to turn a generator on, it would plug right into the panel. So I actually, that was something very good for me to hear.
Yeah. Hey, while we're on hurricanes, tonight is that event about the new kind of, you know, window covering.
Oh, tell me about it again.
Yeah, it's at 6:30 at the Princeville Community Center. It's they brought little pieces of it to our last CERT meeting, and it looks like it's made of plastic, but it's engineered in a certain way, and they said it is, you know, from the illustration they gave, it's like almost unimaginably stronger than plywood on your window, and it is lightweight, and it has industrial strength Velcro on it, so you simply stick it on your house and take it off when the hurricane's over.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. Yeah, and
of
so
course, I'm nervous about how much it might cost, but that seems like a good thing.
Yeah, I don't know how much it's going to cost, but that is 6:30 tonight at Princeville Community Center.
So that's just a little bit over an hour away. Hey, before we move on from KIUC, I just want to also
2 hours, Felicia.
2 hours, excuse me. It's almost 4:30. Did I say an hour? 2 hours. So I'm looking at page 9 of this Currents magazine, and I love that they gave the breakdown. They sort of gave the anatomy of the power poles. I won't sit there and read out what it all is, but when I got this, I went out and I looked at my power pole, and I tried to really sit there and break down what I'm looking at and why it's there. And, you know, I've been an educator, and this is certainly like a great homeschool page, you know, but I hope that we're all curious about these types of things. And especially like when you're talking about a hurricane, it's really important to be able to recognize what's a transformer, or, you know, what's the guy wires or pole ground lines. You know, you need to be able to sit there and be smart about if you're calling in a problem. Now we have cell phones, though they might not work if we have a hurricane, because everything gets knocked down. So that's why you have the radio teams, right? Like, you're a ham radio operator, and so those would continue to work. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. The public service communicators would be on the job.
Public service communicators, and KKCR would be helping to facilitate that, too. And we have, you know, we're designed to be able to be working with, like, you or John Gordon, and being able to make that work.
That's right.
To be able to share out what's going on.
One of the main reasons we're here is for emergency service. If you're on the North Shore, this is the place to tune to get your information.
Yes, KKCR 91.9 FM. And, in fact, that was part of the genesis of Kauai Community Radio. And sometimes people will ask me, well, how come it's on the North Shore? The reason it's on the North Shore is because we up here were out of power. I mean, out of any kind of radio communication for something like 6 months. I can't remember exactly how long. But there was no way to speak to the community up here. It was kind of actually nice in a way, because we didn't have phone, we didn't have television, we didn't have radio, we didn't have anything. So it was really super strong for building community.
Mm-hmm. And did you know of ham radio operators at that time who were relaying information from the North Shore down to...
I'm sure it was happening, but I didn't hear it.
Right.
I mean, you know, But we had, where we were at, we had the National Guard took over an art store right next to our store. So we had all these heroes in here from the Big Island. They were wonderful. We all cried when they left. We had such a good relationship with them. So, anyway, last statement on that, Kauai Island Utility Cooperative Meeting, annual meeting, Thursday, July 27th at, golly, they don't say it right here. They don't have a time. All right, they get a bad mark on their thing here for that one. But it's like, I would bet like 6 o'clock, and maybe you can look that up and see when it is. But that's what's happening with them.
Is that when also they will elect the new, what is it, board of directors?
No, that, no. That's a mail-out piece that comes every year. We have a ballot, and that is something completely different. But, you know, the board of directors will be there for sure, and the key people, and they'll just make a big presentation. Mm-hmm. It's usually a pleasant event. It's pretty quick, and they give away rice and light bulbs is what I always remember. Generally speaking, I go, and I recommend anybody like who is concerned about choices that KIUC is making to please go, you know, and my recommendation would be to email them ahead of time of, you know, concerns that you would really like to hear discussed, mm-hmm. and you could also hand in a written question, and most commonly they hang out afterwards, and you know, if you ask with a smile and you express what you're concerned about, it's, you know, a good place to do it.
Right.
Not attacking is always a little bit better. But like what I was saying at the, I think I said, is, no, I didn't say. I'll say this in a minute. But right now you're listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea. The station that loves you. This is Felicia and Marshall with Kauai Soapbox. Were you looking something up, Marshall?
Well, I was trying to. You know, our internet here is down as well as the phones at the moment, and I have been connected through my phone, but that's being funny, and so it's something to fiddle with when we're not chatting.
Okay, so I would say it's probably like that meeting will most likely start around 6 o'clock, and next week I'll make sure to put it out there. I do want to announce the special event for the Canoe Club that is coming up. And, you know, Kauai Community Radio, we work really hard to also, we have these public service announcements to be really strengthening what's going on in the community. So let's hear from them for just a moment.
Nā Molo Kama o Hanalei Canoe Club presents the 11th annual Hanalei Bay Swim Challenge fundraiser on Saturday, July 29th. Fun competitive swims for all ages, silent auction with prizes including ski vacations in Mammoth Mountain and Telluride. Online registration at HanaleiBaySwimChallenge.com or 760-914-0303. The Open Water Swim Challenge in beautiful Hanalei Bay on July 29th.
On that same point, I can't pull it up on the internet, but I know that there is a whole health fitness event happening in Hanalei too later on in the month, and that's put on by the North Shore Community Foundation. And it's probably, my guess is something encouraging anybody to be able to do. Like, you don't have to be a stellar, you know, triathlete to be able to do it. It's not a heavy competition, but it is a fitness challenge.
Yeah, you know, Felicia, as you know, my family is coming in the first 2 weeks of August. And so I've been looking at what's going on around the island. And boy, it's packed. That's just a hot time for festivals. And so I will be sure to mention all those things. But there's the Mango Festival, the Tahitian Dance, Tahitian Cultural Festival, the Sand Sculpting Contest is going on, the Nepali Challenge is happening, and there's more.
Do you remember when the Mango Festival is at this Sunday, or is it like a couple Sundays out, or you're going to have to look that one up?
It's going to be the first Saturday in August, I do believe, but I'll check.
It's typically a Sunday, pretty sure, but you can look. That's at Waipa on Hanalei Bay, and that's a beautiful event, great music. And at Waipa on the ocean side there, they have the Loka'ia, the fish pond, And just this is, just can't be a more beautiful place. You've got the waterfalls in the background. You've got the ocean right there. You've got the fish pond. And then great music. And it's cool. And it's really nice. I mean, you know, cool from the sun.
Yeah.
Might be a warm day, but.
Yeah. And last year they had the biggest blow-up slide I've ever seen.
Did you
I was
go
just
down?
Standing there. No, I was like, oh, I wish I could, but come on. I mean, I'm.
You're a grown up.
Yeah. I would. I'm sure if I got up there, I would somehow manage to pop the thing and it would deflate. The kids rioting. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you were mentioning some of the things that are happening. So later tonight, actually, at 6:30, there is something called, I've got a Wailua Kapa'a Neighborhood Association Action Alert and the Community Coalition of Kauai. This is at King Kamuli'i School Cafeteria, so it's in Hanamaulu. It's at 6:30 tonight. I'm just going to sort of read what they're saying here, saying, taking back community control of our island. Join us for a strategy and planning meeting where your input makes a difference. So recently, the general plan update process, okay, this is going to be a direct statement here, because they were going to call in too, so I'm just going to read it as is. The recent general plan update process has shown us that the government leadership on Kauai is only interested in the welfare of large landowners, corporate developers, and the tourism industry, not the future of the residents of Kauai. It is up to us in the communities to lead. Around the island, groups with specific interests in land use, conservation, infrastructure, housing, etc., are speaking up about their respective needs and wishes. A purpose-driven conversation with other communities is occurring to see how we can integrate solutions and serve the island as a whole. Community Coalition of Kauai is committed to keeping our beloved Kauai the beautiful island that it has been by taking a forward-thinking approach to managing our growth and visitor industry. Bring your positive ideas, fellow community activists, and leaders to Hanamaulu for an evening and sharing and preparing for the next step in Kauai's future. So that's today, July 11th at 6:30 at King Kamuali'i School Cafeteria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow, interesting. So I guess that some of the concerns that have been brought up here over recent weeks are going to get addressed, like the fact that the general plan update as it stands is based largely on at least debatable, if not entirely inaccurate, information and statistics.
Oh, well, on the visitor industry.
Exactly.
On the visitor
exactly.
industry, yeah.
Yeah. And that, you know, at least according to some, much of the community input that happened over time was actually just dispensed with. And in the end, it didn't come out. So I don't know the details. What do you think?
I probably wouldn't make it be that hard-hitting or complete, but that, I mean, that certainly is a perspective. I have been participating in the general plan update. It's been, you know, it's going on almost 3 years. It was supposed to be a 2-year process. One very big challenge, like a big difference from how it's done in Oahu, is when a version comes out, there's something like 90 days, if not longer, for the community to evaluate it. And last I looked, it's something like 576 pages. I mean, they put a tremendous amount of effort into it. It's cost a lot of money. They had some planners come over and help. I think, you know, everybody tries to do a good job. We have people, and a number of them are in this community coalition of Kauai that have experience in other communities on how to build a document like this a little bit more efficiently. So their outrage is deeper than mine, because pretty much my whole adult life has been here and I haven't seen it done differently somewhere else.
Right.
But so I want to both show respect for our young planners. Most of our planning department is really rather young.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've tried really hard to do a good job. But that said, there's no compelling areas that make sure the goals are hit.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we saw in this planning commission time and in some of the later part when it was really up for review is that the community would come in and they would have their concerns and really compelling statements. And some of the people who are saying this isn't working and why it's not working, like, for example, that the visitor industry numbers that are set are our current standard are actually far less than what we have right now. And what's projected up to 2035 is barely more than what we have now. And so even just this summer, the growth rate has been more profound than what they're estimating between now and 2035. So that's where it doesn't seem like there's any reality in it.
Well, except if we were to take that seriously and had to stick with it and not increase the visitor numbers very much in the coming decades even, and had to put a moratorium on increasing those numbers and maybe even...
But there's nothing like that in there.
Right. So that's not actually the intention.
So it's not the intention. There's no teeth in it. It's just a vision. It is not a policy statement. And so they're saying this is where we see it going, and it doesn't really acknowledge the problem. At first it did, but what we've seen as people come in and complain and come in and complain and come in and complain, or I could use a more positive word, they come in and they give their perspective and say this doesn't seem correct, and they find where one area of the plan doesn't correlate to another area. Like saying there's not going to be more growth, but there's like 4,500 more visitor units stacked in that window of time. And so what I've watched over it is that people come in and raise their striking concerns. Well, then the next revision, actually, instead of going in the direction that the community wanted, it pulls it back and it makes it even more for the developer. So it's like putting your thumb on the scale, and it's tipped to support development. And, you know, there's really almost nothing in there to recognize that, as we're having just noticeably, just even this year, noticeably more traffic on the road, more problems. It cut out the things that had to do with sea level rise. There had been a little bit, not a lot, so now there's almost none in there. At least last I looked, it's like they just removed it. Like, okay, we're not doing a good job, let's take it out. But when you look at places like Kailua or Wailua, where the bridge is on either side, there's places where we would have, if there was a tidal wave, you know, even without a tidal wave, right? If you had a problem, if you had sea level rise, even in Kapa'a and in Kekaha and in Waimea, we would have so much area underwater. So how do we deal with it? So that's not in there.
You know what is interesting? Even with the sort of top-down application of climate change denial in the current administration, the U.S. military is making strategic preparations for the effects.
Right?
Yeah. This was just passed in the Defense Department Appropriations Bill. Bipartisan support on this. And they are tasked with determining the 10 military installations that are most vulnerable to the effects of sea level and other strategic evaluations and steps, you know. So, you know,
I think that's consistent with the priorities of the government, is like making sure that the military is taken care of, you know. And like, even just as an example, we saw that the appropriation for the F-35, which is a new bomber, $406 billion, you know, when at the same time they're cutting health benefits, right? Not that it's even great, but they're trying to cut back on health care. Hopefully there'll be enough push to where it will, with this Affordable Care Act, or what are they calling it now? The health care bill or something like that? The Trump's program, the Trump...
Yeah, Trump care, you know, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
It's not going anywhere.
I mean, but, you know, we need to make some solutions. And I'll be honest, I'm more for a single-payer piece, but...
You know what? More and more people are saying that. It used to be kind of a radical suggestion. And now, I think when people are actually realizing the people are learning more about healthcare and how it works in this country. And when they're seeing how despicable is the proposal from the Republicans right now, people are actually stepping back and saying, what do we really need? Actually, what do we really need? We just want everybody to have healthcare.
Right. And then pulling it back for a moment to this meeting tonight on the general plan update, that's the kind of the same type of thing at a local level, as we say, what do we really need? Where do we want our water? Where do we want all these different pieces? And it's about to go to the county council. And at the county council, it's not their job to be looking at it deep, deep, deep. And with our existing council, it's not likely that they will go deep, deep, deep. What happens, you know, even say for the planning commission, you know, they wanted it to make it through there in 2 months. It's been more like 6 months, and it pushes aside almost all the other aspects that they're supposed to be looking at. So it slows things down. If they spend 6 months at the council looking at the general plan update, then it would push aside so many other important things. My guess is that these guys are just going to say yes, mm-hmm. because they tend to be a pretty pro-business majority in there, and this general plan update is definitely a pro-business general plan.
So when you take a look at the current version of the general plan update and think about where that takes us as an island, you know, in the next 20 years, say, what do we look like at the end of that time in your mind if we follow the recommendations in this plan?
Well, I mean, you know, if I have to, like, zoom the camera back a little bit.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And when we zoom the camera back a little bit, I think there's about 7 billion people on the planet now. Have we hit that number solidly? Do you know?
Yes.
Do you know?
Okay, I don't know solidly. It's around 7 billion.
It's right around 7 billion.
Yeah.
And if we continue on the almost exponential curve that humanity is growing at, you know, maybe we'll have another billion people by the time 2035 goes around, and we are on one of the most beautiful places on the entire planet. So what we're seeing here is the pressure of the whole global economy. Everybody wants to be here if they can, if
That's
not
true.
Just for a little bit of time. And what we also see that is not the fault of the people who are elected is that the federal government keeps upping the standards of how the roads have to be, how the water system has to be, how the trash system has to be. In fact, we have such high standards for building a house. They have to be able to withstand a tidal wave, a hurricane, a big flood, everything else. So the standards are so high, nobody can afford a house, and people don't have a house anymore. You know, 50 years ago, if you needed a house, you got a hammer and some nails and some wood, and you were able to build something.
Yeah, and hundreds of years ago, people in many places would grab some bamboo out of the forest and whip it up, and it's resistant to hurricanes and tidal waves and everything else.
And if it blows away, then you build another one.
That's right.
So having such secure building codes, we have homeless people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's this big cycle. It's really, you know, I use this analogy all the time, but it's like joining the Monopoly game after 15 rounds have already been played and then deciding to blame it on some of the others. In fact, this week I've been hearing a lot of acrimony about which elected official is, you know, somehow of really bad character, or, you know, like all this slamming of different people. And when I ask people, well, why, what did they do? It's not so easy for people to actually answer it. All they really know is I don't like the way it's going, and it seems like I don't have a home, or there are so many people who don't have a home, or people are angry. Like, there's a lot of anger in the community right now as people have, I think, started to learn about where there's been a lot of deceptive politics at every level, and certainly in terms of our local history. So there's a lot of this acrimony that's going on. But the system is designed to concentrate power and wealth upward. And then there's a natural tendency for, you know, elements of power to try and stay holding on to their power. And,
sure.
And when you just pick things, and like For example, I'm trying to decide if I want to go to the county council meeting tomorrow morning. As people who are regular listeners of this show, Kauai Soapbox, with Felicia and Marshall, and we can't take calls right now because our phone isn't working and our internet isn't really working. So that's why it's just us talking. But I've been following the Charter Review Commission. And when Brian Baptiste first came up with this idea and the council at the time, we had so many little flaws in our charter that was written in, I think, like 1962 by just a few people. And at that time, we had a very robust sugar industry that was still in place. And the sugar communities, like Kilauea was one, you know, everybody had, you know, Hanamaulu was one. The sugar companies actually were pretty patriarchal, and they provided often the medical, and they fixed the roads and the waters and all that stuff. So when the county charter was written, there were big landowners that took care of a lot of the problems. And as that has transitioned, and then there's all these big federal regulations that Hawaii, because Hawaii has only been a state since 1959, this charter was written in the first couple few years. The charter is archaic in a number of ways. So they decided, okay, let's do a charter review commission for 10 years, and we'll look at the charter, and we'll fix it. But I have watched the charter review commission, and people come in as they get appointed, and they don't even have any training. They don't really know. They kind of learn on the fly, and mostly it has been an opportunity for different departments of the government to say, hey, I need this, or we want to get paid more here, or, you know, have these things go on the ballot. And I think maybe only two, maybe three citizen initiatives have actually made it to the ballot. It's very difficult to get it on the ballot. And then they don't pass, or they pass, and then they get challenged and killed. And so it was supposed to happen in 10 years. They didn't really do an effective job. And last charter review group, they said, hey, let's extend ourselves indefinitely. And it is never meant to be that way, because these are completely unelected officials, and it never goes really through public scrutiny. You have to be very vigilant to understand how to find it on, you know, www.kauai.gov. Then you go to Charter Review Commission, and 6 days before their next meeting, they will give out the next agenda. And so if you aren't wonkish, a lot of people don't even know what that means, Charter Review Commission. They're basically, it's like seven people in this room making a decision.
Yeah, and is there much thought and discussion that goes into those decisions? And
well,
you've been in these meetings.
I go to these meetings, yeah. And I've definitely had just a conniption. And tomorrow morning, they're picking two more people. Like in the last election, they put, I think, seven, maybe eight ballot initiatives on there. And when they published it, they intentionally only published the pros. They intentionally framed the questions so people would say yes. They stated as a reason to keep it quiet is KKCR. They don't want people knowing the negativities on it. And it is a concentration of power. One of the key people who was the chair of that board at the time, that commission, he also is a writer for the Garden Island newspaper, and so he wrote several articles just, you know, making it really smarmy and easy of why everybody should say yes.
Did he disclose in those articles that he was...
No.
Really?
Definitely not. So,
really?
Yeah. And so they voted to have it in there to make it perpetual. And I was in the meeting when Jay Fufaro, who was the head of the Board of Commissions, he said, well, after they confirmed it, then he said to them, well, you know, it's got to be a whole new board. It's not going to be you, a new commission. And they all went, oh, like, well, we hadn't anticipated that.
Right.
And they had missed that little nuance.
Right.
So I feel like I want to be on that commission.
Right.
I've certainly put in my application. I put in my application like three or four different times. You never hear a single yes or no. There is no transparency on what they pick.
Who does the application go to, and who makes the decisions?
Well, the mayor makes most of the decisions. It used to be the mayor would make one decision, pick one, and then the council would pick one. You know, they each could submit something to it. It goes before the council, but they almost always just say yes. So tomorrow morning, they have two more people. They're trying to stack it now, and they'll make those decisions. And so sometimes I've been really, really unhappy that they pick people who are not following it. They're not really active in government, and I think that they're too busy doing whatever job they do to actually understand the nuances of what's in there. And maybe they haven't even lived here that long. You know, there's a lot of different things like that.
Is that something that public support would be appropriate for one person or another who applies to be on the Charter Review Commission?
What I would like to see, I would like to see all boards and commission applications be online, so that they can't tell you no. Anybody who's interested could go in, and it would be transparent who's applied, so that when one is selected, they could see the 10 people who applied, and they could look and go, well, that makes sense. That seems like a really good person to be able to be chosen for that. Or if they're picking somebody that is less than appropriate, or really kind of an under-experienced person who's going to just simply vote yes or no, that would be visible. But so tomorrow morning, they are going to be hearing for two new Charter Review Commissioners, both of whom incredibly capable, incredibly well-suited for this choice. But one is Jan Ten Bruggenkate, who is on and has been the chair of the board of the Kauai Island Utilities Cooperative, and he wrote the book about Grove Farm, and he is super involved with Grove Farm. So, and then Jan was the chair of the last Charter Review Commission. So even though it's supposed to be a new one, well, they're picking the same old guy, right? So he's coming in there. Can he do it? Yes. Is he intelligent? Yes. Is he capable? Yes. Very intelligent, almost too intelligent, because he kind of seems like he thinks he's smarter than everybody else, and that might be, but you need to be able to respect everybody's opinion. And I personally, while I get along with him just fine, I think it's a conflict of interest to have somebody grow farm that controls our water, KIUC that controls our electric. Now, it certainly makes him well-versed in understanding what's going on. But what was the clear goal in the past one, and they didn't get, is to disempower the people from being able to get their own ballot on there. And they pretty much never really floated out there to the community of where are you unhappy. And when I've gone to the meetings, they're not even asking the government where are you unhappy. It seems like it's mostly special interests that come forward to make a change. And then Ricky Watanabe is the other person who, I have to say, I actually really like him a lot. And he's a lawyer who was the chair of the county council. The clerk for the county clerk, who works for the county council. And so he's incredibly appropriate because he's somebody who has probably knows the charter like the back of his hand. Good person. Pretty close to when he was the chair, and he was the one who was in that really, really awkward position of getting punted the ball when Kauai Rising had a pesticide ordinance ballot initiative on there looking to basically put the burden of proof on the industry. That's the essence of what it was. It's saying, okay, fine, you can do whatever you want. You just have to get tested. The air, the water, and the land in the surrounding areas, you just have to prove what you're saying is correct, that there is no drift of any kind of contaminants that is going to hurt anybody, and you have to pay for it through a permit. And there were a few little weaknesses in the bill, but there was no effort to actually help them correct those weaknesses. And, you know, one time they knocked it out because it was like the wrong kind of paper. You know, they had they kicked it out, said, okay, this isn't appropriate, and they gave some sideways reason. So people had to go out and get all the signatures all over again in 3 weeks, and they did it. There was a whole lot of people who wanted this, and it could have set a precedent across the country. Hmm. And that's one of the reasons that they just couldn't allow it to go, because really, not just for the pesticide industry, but what happens is rural communities that do not have the capacity to show damage, like there's no much damage, we could have, you know, 100 people be dying of something, it still wouldn't be statistically significant because there's not enough people. It's like trying to prove that secondhand smoke is going to do damage in a room full of 100 people. You know, how do you do that? You know, instead of just saying, okay, there's plenty of evidence that this happens. So they take advantage of small rural communities who can't economically fight it, who can't create it. And in like a case like Kauai or Hawaii, the majority of the legislators live on Oahu. The people over there, they live in these high-rise buildings. They don't even really sit there and contemplate how close these fields are to the schools and the houses. And so we are an excellent example of how rural areas can get damaged. And if that bill had been able to become an ordinance and allowed to function, it could have helped the entire country. And the person who wrote that, Bob Yonke, who's a lawyer, he's not a Hawaii lawyer. He did the Clear Skies Act. He did three major pieces of legislation that made it through the Supreme Court that changed environmental law for the better. So this could not go through. And so it got signed in, went in again, and that bill was determined to be up to the county clerk to decide if it was valid or not. That's completely unfair to the county clerk. And
that was Ricky?
Ricky Watanabe.
Uh-huh.
And he did punt it back and said no. So, like...
Wait. He punted it back by saying...
No, we won't take the bill. We won't allow this ballot initiative on the ballot.
The reasons given were what?
Well, I'm trying to remember. I mean, I know the reason. Some of the reasons that they didn't want to allow it is that in the balance of power at the county level, the mayor's office is supposed to be the executive branch picks the department heads and has that control, where the legislative branch, which is the county council, would be, they're supposed to decide if something's funded or not, or to allow it to be a law. So there's a balance of power issue. And in that bill, it got a little too detailed. Some of it seemed like an ordinance. Some of it seemed, it got too detailed on how to do it, how to be looking at it. So it said what to do rather than just the big piece. And then the other piece was, and it would have worked against the goals of the group who put it on the ballot, but it said that the county council would be selecting the ag position to be doing enforcement on the farms, so to be looking at it. And even though there are a few examples, like the county council selects the auditor and not the mayor's office, that was something that wasn't really, you know, completely in alignment very well with it. And the industry was telling the county, we will sue you for that, just like we sued you for the ordinance that passed.
Right.
So they were like, And so Ricky, that was something that I don't think was really I didn't think it was noble of the council to put it on him to make the decision, because he's not elected. It should have been that all the requirements were made with the signatures, it goes on the ballot, let's say it passed, then it needs to be determined in court, just the same way that ordinance did. So that's what happened there. But Ricky, I like him.
And so now he's up tomorrow morning to be on the Charter Review Commission.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like two competent people, but guaranteed they're going to stack it to pull the power away from the people. And I think, well, who's giving the power to you guys? Nobody asked us. ever. And if I'm not bringing it up on the radio, probably nobody would even notice the issue.
Right. And so what happens tomorrow? Is it just formalities, or is this a period for the public to have some input?
Well, people could go in and have some input, or they could email council testimony at testimony with a Y, not an IES, council testimony at kauai.gov, and in their subject line, they could say, I support your choice for the Charter Review Commission, or you could say, I don't support it, or you could say, I have concerns because.
Mm-hmm. And could you say, well, you know, I would rather support this other person?
No, not really. I mean, you could say it. Certainly you could say anything you want,
right.
But whether that would matter or not. Or you could go in there and you could watch. Like what typically happens is there's nobody even in there.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody realizes, okay, I don't have to even be accountable.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to say both of these people are definitely competent. You couldn't say this is incompetence. We're just past the top of the hour. You're listening to Kauai Soapbox with Felicia and Marshall, and we are talking about a whole lot of different topics. Our normal phone line, 826-7771, seems to be a little bit on the blink. We're waiting for that to get fixed. You can try it.
I'll try it now. I'll check.
Well, just a moment. Yes. Don't start doing it while I'm talking. Okay. So Kauai Soapbox is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with The Copper Man and Second Skin. So we really do deeply appreciate these underwriters. Brings us on the air.
KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ Anahola, K284AL Haleiwa.
The Copper Man. Copper, stainless steel, and galvanized aluminum. We specialize in ornamental and custom work and fabricate and install any kind sheet metal work, residential and commercial. Serving Kauai for over 30 years. We're still talking. HarryConti.com. That's HarryConti.com. Or 639-3456. PackYourTrash.org and SaveRCs.us.
Second Skin Organics Hawaiian Mosquito Shield. Safe and effective. Protecting you and your ohana since 2001. Kauai grown, GMO free, sustainable organic agriculture based solutions. Uamau ke'ea oka'aina I kapono. More information on their global mission and vision for Hawaii at secondskinorganics.com.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. So, Marshall, the phone isn't working?
No, it's still not working. You get a busy signal.
Okay, well, we appreciate our listeners, and we appreciate all the effort. And so we kind of went on long about the general plan update and then creating effective government and, you know, helping the listener to be aware that tomorrow morning they're going to be picking two more charter review commissioners. All these commissioners, they are volunteer, they are unpaid, they are big tasks, but there's a lot of power that goes behind it. And so sometimes, you need to engage. If you don't engage, it's going to concentrate towards the powerful. And even like, you know, powerful, we're talking about power, Kauai Island Utility Cooperative that makes power, Jan Ten Bruggenkate, on the board of both now the Charter Review Commission probably tomorrow. They will approve it. People could go in and make a testimony. And Kauai Island Utility Cooperative and Kukui Grove, like KIUC also, it was pretty interesting for me. Real nice woman, no complaint. They have another person on their team, Pua Chin, who happens to also be the representative for Kauai for the Department of Hawaiian Homelands. And, I was like, oh, you know, that is interesting that that's there, because another topic that comes up here on this station a lot, and we do tend to have a high focus on serving our Hawaiian community, the Kanaka Mo'oli people, there is Department of Hawaiian Homelands land that has been sitting waiting for people for a very long time, and these lands don't get developed. And even in fact, the land right there where the power station is, right next to the other Department of Hawaiian Homelands neighborhood in Anahola, there is a big solar farm on that property now, and that was right contiguous with the other neighborhood. So you'd think, why not put that land there? And I went to the DHHL meeting, the Department of Hawaiian Homelands meeting, and, you know, here they get the power right from the DHHL beneficiaries, and yet, you know, they are still all paying regular power rates. You know, those lands, they can find a use for it that is appropriate to everybody, like put a jail on it or a military base or an airport. But they can't find a way to use it for the people. And so on the general plan update, they want to move the existing sewage treatment plant. And where they want to put that on is more Department of Hawaiian Homelands lands in Wailua. And if things go the normal way, the sewage treatment plant will be on there. Like, I brought that up at the meeting, and even though I am not of blood quantum, and but I did ask, well, you're going to put that on there? And they said, well, if we were going to put the Department of Hawaiian Homelands on there, we need to have a sewage treatment plant for that too, so it would be for both. But what happens is that water is diverted in the upper north fork of the Wailua River, and it's taken over into Kapaya and Hanamaulu, so Grove Farm is able to then manage that water. Again, Errol Kaneshiro, who's on the county council, Jan Tan Brugengate, who's going to be on the Charter Review Commission. That water also is used by KIUC. When they have all this overlap, at one level it makes them really appropriate, and then at another level it makes it somewhat a real insider game. And so we don't have the money, I mean, we don't have the water to be able to utilize all that land over there in Wailua for the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, because they say, well, we don't have the water for the infrastructure. Oh, well, why not? Oh, because it's over there for Grove Farm. And then they say, well, but it's on the other side of the bridge, but really the DHHL land is on the other side, on the south side of the Wailua Bridge. Like, there's a goal to concentrate the population on the south side of the Wailua Bridge, because that's where the airport is. And if we had a hurricane or an earthquake or a crisis, the airport's there, the hospital's there. When we can cluster services, it's easier to make it work in a more narrow area than to spread it all out. But, you know, there's conflict of interest when, you know, do you get somebody who's so involved, or do you have somebody who doesn't have any knowledge about it? You know, it's really not a very easy thing, but that's a little bit of a problem.
Yeah, there must be a happy medium. There must be people who are very familiar with the water systems and don't have commercial
bias.
Interests.
Yeah. So that's an issue. Also tonight, Kilauea Neighborhood Association, they are having their meeting. It starts at 7 o'clock, and I think that one of the things that will be going on there is talking about the new shopping center that's happening right in that area.
Lighthouse Village, right?
Lighthouse Village. And, again, that's like, you know, how do you make it be a win-win? I mean, I live half a block from that, and, you know, people expect me to be really bummed out about it. And, you know, I mean, if it stayed an open field, yay, I'm totally happy with it. And if I can not have to get in my car to go over and have a burrito or buy
what?
Some toilet paper or, you know, what, you know, just the mundane things. Like for me, I'm okay, really, honestly. People get mad at me if I say that, but then I don't have to get in my car.
Right.
I kind of like that.
You know, I try not to go even as far as Kapa'a from the North Shore, where I live, any more than every couple few weeks. I've needed shoelaces for 2 weeks, and I'm just not going to run down there for them. you know? It's that kind of thing. We don't have a place to get even that kind of sundries.
We used to. Yeah. You know, Hanalei, we had the variety store, and you could buy a toaster in there. You could buy a clock in there, you know. Now, part of the reason we have so much traffic issues is because people, you know, drive to Lihui to buy shampoo, you know. You can get that in Princeville, but I mean, it's like
25 cents more expensive.
Yeah, so to me, I basically buy local if I can. I'll spend 70 cents more a gallon if it keeps a gas station working in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Because I was a retailer, I think I'm extra conscious of the importance of buying locally. But so when we are seeing things like a shopping center, what I also like with most of the businesses right in Kilauea, they hire the community. It's mm-hmm. like a lot of people are really just biking distance away from work.
Yeah.
So I think that that's the solution, and I think that in Kilauea, there will be a lot more of that. Like, it's sort of a bedroom community, so people have to drive to Kapa'a or Lihui to work or to Princeville or to Hanalei to work. We don't have a big opportunity to work. It used to be a sugar town. It's not anymore. And so I think that, like, if people can live and work and shop and have most of their needs met right in the narrow area, that's a resilience perspective that I actually support.
Yeah, and speaking of win-wins, they're going to put that bypass road in, right? It's going to go past the post office down to the lighthouse.
In theory, I mean, that's got to be that's a county budget item.
Okay.
And so, like...
Oh, that's not guaranteed. I thought that was kind of part of the deal. We're going to put a shopping center here, but you're going
to... What was part of the deal was the neighbor land owner was good enough to... He had to CPR or subdivide his property, and so one of those property pieces is the roadbed, and that is going to be dedicated to the county to put a road in. But, you know, if you... Here's the thing. Like, if you... make sure that little shopping center puts the road in, well, then there's no viability for the shopping center.
Mm.
If they have to, probably to put that road in, I'm not sure, but I know you can spend $100,000 just putting in a parking lot, you know, a small parking lot for a shopping center.
Mm.
So if they had to put $3 million in to pave a road to the standards, then there's no viability in the rent to the tenant.
You know, that's interesting because there's something that expense is based on the tourist industry. We wouldn't need that road except for all the tourists driving down to the lighthouse.
I'm going to disagree with you on that,
too. Okay, all right.
We wouldn't need that road if there wasn't all the tourists on Kuhio Highway.
Mm-hmm.
If Kuhio Highway wasn't incredibly overwhelmed with visitors.
Right.
And people working the visitor industry also, if it wasn't incredibly overwhelmed, then that you'd be have no problem. We wouldn't need that road. I live on that road, and I used to live in Kuhio Highway.
I'm talking about the proposed bypass road.
Well, the proposed bypass road, you say we wouldn't need it if it wasn't for the visitors?
Right.
No, I'm going to 100% disagree with that.
Okay, good. Inform me. You're a long-time resident of Kilauea.
I live right there.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it is so dangerous to turn left out of Kilauea, and it's almost really dangerous to turn left into Kilauea. So people die just coming out of the road, and, you know, there's a lot of resistance from people who don't have to make that left turn every day to not wanting to have a stoplight because it will ruin the rural ambiance to have a light on the North Shore. But the way that the road structure is right there, it's really dangerous because it's congested. There's a thrift store and a gas station and tamales and lychees and everything being sold. So as people turn left, they're committed to turning left. There's congestion on the road right there, and they can't get all the way in. They can get T-boned by oncoming traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And we have people die. And it's frightening to get out. And even Kalihiwai Road Mm-hmm. You might sit there for 10 minutes trying to turn left. Mm-hmm. And then when you go, you're making a reckless turn. And we did just, you know, lose somebody this year right there, a motorcycle rider from Kapahi, born and raised here.
You know, I keep thinking, well, they could at least lower the speed limit there. That's 50 miles an hour going by a small road with no turn lane.
With no turn lane, and the vegetation grows so thick you can hardly see out of it, and people behind you are all frustrated and wanting you to take a risk. So those are challenges that the county has to look at, and how do they pay for it? Now, that's a state highway, but when you're looking at where a state highway hits a county road, who is responsible for paying for the stoplight, right? So, and where does the money come from? And people can't afford their taxes. All this stuff is part of the general plan update, by the way. Mm-hmm. And why would somebody on the other side of the island want to put that kind of investment into our little road in Kilauea? You know, so we have all those challenges. And so if the shopping center had to pay for that improvement, the rent, it invalidates the reason to be there. And what we have is another issue, and all this feeds into educating the listener about why we need to all think about and participate. It affects your very life. It could affect, do you lose your child or your grandmother or whatever, who may be a little bit more feeble in making their turn. Some people are stronger drivers than others. When we need to think about how we do our water and our roads, like in Kilauea, we are at the very end of a very long line of water. Our water really comes from Kapaa. So, like, here we are. I live in Kilauea, and we're whining that Grove Farm is taking the water from Wailua. Well, what? Kilauea is taking the water from Kapaa, right? We're on that same water line. We're at the very end of the water line. We need a water line here in Kilauea, and we actually have the reservoirs, but they have been purchased and sold on lands that have it. In fact, like, I went to you can do like a real estate caravan. You can go. I used to have my real estate license. I never sold any real estate, but I did get to get my training. I like to learn things, and it's made me a better buyer. So I went on a real estate caravan, and the lands that were sold, I'm not going to say who it was, but I feel like it, but they sold these lands to high-end buyers. And part of the whole thing was saying the main aquifer for the Kilauea area is right here, and you will personally own it. And what that does is it forces the slowing of growth for Kilauea, because you do not have to share the water with the town. And so it was sold with that knowledge. It was a sales point of taking. And I look at things, too. I won't name names, but, like, one of the major real estate companies that sells to these very high-end buyers also is the head of the Hawaii Land Trust, which sounds like a really nice thing, but the Hawaii Land Trust, that's part of what sells these big pieces of property, because they say, okay, you can dedicate it to conservation, you can do all these things, it sounds really good, but it basically helps when people buy 300 acres or 700 acres or an area where they are blocking access to the beach or the mountain. They say, you turn it into a conservation zone, we'll put it in a land trust. It reduces their tax base. They can reduce the tax base, so it helps the sale of the land. So, you know, there's this all this overlap and intermarrying of things. And so something that sounds really good, yay, that land doesn't get exploited, I suppose. But, oh, nobody else can live there. Nobody else can go there. And then they're not paying the tax on the land. And none of this stuff gets questioned, you know. And even like when a station like KKCR, a lot of pushback for bringing up these nuances. And when I bring these things up on the radio, it's because listeners constantly bombard us with this information. Mm. And part of our mission statement is to give life to the voice of the underserved.
Right.
And there are even people once in a while, like, that work in the government or work in industry, they will call from a pay phone or whatever, and they will give information. A lot of times people that work in different organizations, they share the same concern as a citizen, but they can't afford to speak up,
right,
because then they won't be able to fund themselves. I'm looking at my little list of announcements. So Kilauea Neighborhood Association meeting tonight, 7 o'clock at the Kilauea Neighborhood Center. Hawaii Farmers Union United meeting Wednesday, 6 p.m. It always starts with a buffet of all Kauai food.
Potluck.
Potluck. That's at Anahola Neighborhood Center. On Wednesday, at I'm going to show up at 5. I think it really starts at 5:30, is that film Ku Kanaka, Stand Strong. We had Marlene Booth on our show last week talking about what that meant and what the sovereignty movement is. And it's the story of about a professor and young man who had broken his neck at 15 years old and became a quadriplegic, and how his life parallels what he learned about what has happened to the nation of Hawaii. And so
you can hear that interview archived right now on your website, FeliciaKaladin.com.
Yes, and then go to KKCR, like under, what is it, under
projects.
Projects. So
right.
You could go to KKCR, or you see some links right there on the front page, so you can listen to any of our shows or see some of the YouTubes that we do off that. There's going to be a panel discussion. I'm thinking about Victor Punua Jr., the younger one, who was his roommate. He's going to be among the panelists that are there talking, and then certainly the filmmaker. So that is tomorrow on Thursday from 11 to 3 at Kealia Farm, the College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources Livestock Extension Agent is going to be giving a natural farming method for pigs workshop. We're not allowed to say prices,
right,
but if you had no money at all, you could go with no problem.
Uh-huh, interesting. So is that Korean natural farming? Do you know specifically?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Wow, I have heard that that's just
it's a way to keep the poop from smelling.
Yeah, and that it's almost unbelievably successful.
Right, and the animal is clean and healthier and digests food better.
Right, people who have been around raising pigs for a long time are just stunned. Stunned that this is possible.
Yes. So 11 to 3 at Kealia Farm, so that's just inland about, I don't know, maybe a tenth of a mile, and to the south side of Kealia Road, right there across from Kealia Beach, just beyond the post office. So that's happening. Another big element, this is at a national level. Let me see if I can, I think I have it sort of loaded on my computer, even though the internet is not working. See if I can pull it up.
What's it about?
It's about net neutrality, and this is an effort across across the country to be really paying attention to what is going on at the federal level and who has been assigned to the Federal Communications Commission is a guy named Ajit Pat. No, Ajit Pai, I don't really know him, but he was a lawyer for Verizon. He's the chairman of this group. So Verizon is one of the cable providers and one of the very major internet providers.
Mm-hmm.
And they what they want to do is limit access for people who aren't big payers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. We want to make the internet a prioritized place rather than giving everyone equal access. Yeah,
that's right. So what that means is if you do a search on Kauai.gov, for example, and they don't pay for a premium rate. You might have to sit there and load and load and load for a long time, or you can't get into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting about how we take for granted, really, at this point, how level a playing field the internet really is. You know, anyone that wants to put enough time and energy into search engine optimization can have something come out well in search results.
It's done a lot to level the playing field for the average person to be able to be contributing to the larger dialogue. Now, something that's interesting, so what's happened is tomorrow is July 12th is a day of action, and they are asking people to be emailing the Federal Communications Commission and saying, I support net neutrality, and also to be telling their own representatives, like for us that would be Senator Brian Schatz or Mazie Hirono. And then we have Tulsi Gabbard is our representative, mm-hmm. and Colleen Honabusa for Oahu. But, you know, there is a big, huge list of people who want to hold what's called Title II net neutrality. And this has been, this comes up again and again. But these are companies that you'd think, okay, well, maybe they wouldn't do it. But it's like Netflix, Kickstarter, Etsy, Vimeo, Twitter, Reddit. I mean, there's a big, huge list. I'm trying to see if Facebook is on here yet. I am not seeing Facebook, but this is, I'm just going down and down and down, you know, of big, like Weebly, Women's March, that's kind of a smaller one, Yelp, Think Green, Spotify, Amazon, you know, Media Alliance. There's so many big players that are saying, we don't even want to have the upper hand. Don't do it. Don't do it.
Oh, really? They're arguing for neutrality.
They are arguing for net neutrality. Credo, that's a phone company. I'm looking at a big
So, big, you know, list. This. I think this is the third time, actually, that there has needed to be a grassroots effort to hold on to net neutrality.
Yeah.
Not the first time it's happened, but, you know, the good news is that we know that it's possible for people speaking up to make a difference. Yeah, it has so far.
Yeah. So there has been the big output for tomorrow. They want to overwhelm the Federal Communication Commissions and the legislature with desire to uphold Title II net neutrality. So that's a big piece. Just trying to look for a few other little things. Who we were expecting a call in today to, just so you guys know, but the phone didn't work, is the people doing the poison drop.
Lahua
Island. And so to their credit, they know people are stressed out about it, so they wanted to call in and talk about that.
And they had come into the studio before.
Twice.
Yeah.
And I went to the meeting. There is just a few things. So then we're going to, at the bottom of the hour, we're going to talk to Andy Sarhanis a little bit about what Henry David Thoreau's world is about. So one thing that's coming up, like what I was feeling, is there's a lot of things, like how do we find a win-win? How do we find where we pick something that's good for everybody? Usually whenever there's any kind of law or a movement, it's a blessing for some, it's a bummer for others. So a few that I have watched, because I have on my Facebook wall many, many parents of vaccine-injured kids or lost kids, and these are real people, you know, and so their pain is very real. In France and Italy, they are pushing really hard for a mandatory vaccine effort. So it's like they will take your kids away from you if you don't let them get vaccinated. And that, to me, is just about the most vile thing that I could imagine. Though I
taking a child away from
and
his
forcing
or her,
and yeah. forcing them to vaccinate the kid, like, because if they know, and what's overwhelming evidence is that it's a very small percentage, but that percentage is just like playing Russian roulette with your kid, and maybe there's only a bullet in, you know, 1 of 100 chambers, but you could lose your child or lose your child's mind.
What happens?
We could go long on that. Like, mm-hmm. what, I mean, other than the kid dying, you know, there's all kinds of...
So in a certain number of cases, children die as a result of having a vaccination.
Yes, or mm-hmm. they have permanent brain injury. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the group that says, oh, no, that's not true, that's like climate science deniers. There's something called, there's vaccine court. And so if you have a vaccine-injured child, you can get paid off for it. But there is no consequence whatsoever to these pharmaceutical companies that do it. And so they keep upping the stuff. But like what I was going to say, where I kind of get it a little bit with France and Italy, is that they have such an overwhelming amount of immigrants coming in from places that have serious disease and illness,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, is a very legitimate fear.
So you think the vaccines do work?
They work. Is it, you know, but if you're not going to be exposed to it and our immune systems work better, right? But you can have a problem, right? You can have a problem. My kids are vaccinated, but I actually feel guilty about it mm-hmm. now that I've learned as much as I have.
Mm-hmm.
But they're okay. So that's good. I succeeded on that. You're listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea with Felicia and Marshall. So that's one piece and... one other little tiny story I wanted to just, because I get calls in. Somebody gave me a little piece of their employment challenge, because we look at how hard it is to live here. And this is another one where there's that balance of, well, what's fair and what's not fair, and when you require liability insurance. So for a small-scale person who does landscaping, this person who really... works for one person because it's a big enough job that it's one person, but what happens is they go, okay, you're contract and not an employee, so that they avoid being able to have to pay the cost of that. But then requiring that person to have liability insurance, and then that person going, okay, I'll go get liability insurance so I can mow the lawn and, you know, take care of the bushes and stuff, and that liability insurance is $500 a month. So then it's no longer worth doing the job. And what I see and I hear from different employers is they say they can't even find anybody to work. You know, they go, nobody wants a job is because it's not worth it to work. It's too expensive to be able to work, and even sometimes too expensive to volunteer. So we have those challenges. So those challenges, the challenges that we face now, they've been faced in other centuries really heavily, even from the very beginning. As soon as outsiders from whatever area tend to come into a new community, it's not just where Europeans show up. It can be where any group of people tend to invade another space and take it over. Sometimes there is loss of life, loss of land, you know, killings and things like that. So when the United States was a young country, already we were having environmental damage and human rights abuse. I mean, that kind of, our country began with that. And so Henry David Thoreau was somebody who was one of the early interveners on that. And Andy Sarhanis is one of our listeners and definitely an environmental farmer. And he has asked to be able to share some stuff. And this is a really important day, 200-year anniversary. So, Andy, your mic is on, and I want you to talk directly into it. So help us understand, again, Henry David Thoreau's influence and what the circumstances were in his time period. When did he reach adulthood?
Yeah, he was, excuse me, he was born in 1817. He died at the age of 42 in the early 1860s. And he was a transcendentalist, and he was a student under Emerson, who developed the transcendental theology. The transcendental is a school of thought, spirituality, philosophy.
Is it like transcendental meditation?
No.
No. Okay.
Transcendentalist basically means that in nature, God is transcendent everywhere.
So what does transcendent mean? It means that he's everywhere?
That he's everywhere. And then
in the rocks, in the air,
yes,
in the water.
Exactly.
So that's actually pretty consistent with the traditional belief system of our Hawaiian community.
I believe that's called panentheism.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Okay.
But anyways, but like I say, it was actually, there was a, see, they both live in Concord, Massachusetts. I'm from Massachusetts myself. And Concord was the intellectual and literary capital of the United States. In fact, the most significant place in the whole 19th century in those regards. And Emerson wrote the book Nature, which...
So yeah. Can I say, yeah, most significant piece on that among the dominant culture, right? I'm sure the Native Americans that had most of the Western United States were also at least as aware of the environment.
Well, of course.
So,
yeah,
I mean, but
yeah,
I just want to say that because I know when I was a kid, they say, oh, Balboa was the first man to see the Pacific Ocean. Yeah. And I'd think, well, gosh, where were all the Indians, you know? I mean, so of the European community in America, he was one of the first to be really writing, well, Ralph Waldo Emerson also, but they were writing about how important it is to be connected with that.
Right, right. Yeah, and Thoreau is the first Anglo-American literary figure, author, to write about the wisdom and the greatness of Native Americans.
Okay.
He was the first, you know.
And did he hang out with them?
He had sufficient experience with them. They were his guides when he made four journeys to the Maine woods, which later was put into a book called The Maine Woods, which I read.
And you're talking about state of Maine.
The state of Maine, yes. And
which is in the far eastern, northeastern part of the United States,
yeah,
right next to Canada.
Exactly. It's the furthest northeast state in the Union. It's just north of Massachusetts.
And Massachusetts is in New England in the northeast part of the country.
Correct. Anyways,
you got Connecticut and Vermont and New Hampshire in there somewhere.
In Rhode Island. Yeah. No,
right.
I'm gifted in geography. Uh-huh. So I have a whole snapshot of the whole country.
Yeah.
And then
does Massachusetts border Maine? Is that correct?
No.
It doesn't. No.
No.
No. But at one time, Maine was part of Massachusetts. Then it broke off and became its own state in 1820.
And then little states popped up in between.
I don't want to get into this story. We don't have time.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
That's another chapter. So anyways, and so Emerson's book, Nature, was radical because it challenged the church's authority over someone's spirituality, relationship with the universe, that you didn't have to go to church to experience God, that God was transcendent everywhere. And there was a whole slew of transcendental authors and philosophers, and I don't have time to get into it. And Concord was like the hub. And a lot of these people lived there, like Nathaniel Hawthorne. He was one. Louisa May Alcott. And anyways, and Thoreau, you know, he has this reputation, or people have sort of like put him into a box as he's this sort of like crank, nonconformist, gruffy, grouchy hermit who doesn't want to deal with anyone in society, that just lives in the woods. Yet Walden Pond, if there was a Walden Pond around here, it could be just one of the remote beaches that anyone mm-hmm. can hike
right.
to. It was a common day hike of 30 minutes from Concord Center. And Thoreau was a he grew watermelons, and every summer he'd have a watermelon party on Walden Pond. He was famous for doing that, you know. But anyway, so he was quite a, you know, diverse in many ways. He was a poet and a scientist, and he coined the term. He was the first to use the term forest succession. He studied succession in nature in trees, and then he had a book that he was working on called The Dispersal of Seeds. And it was put into a book 100 years after he died, and I have that here. And the book is called Faith in the Seed.
Oh, love that name.
Yeah. And there's a quote in here that could be the epitaph for any organization that's promoting seeds. And here it is. Though I do not believe that a plant will spring up where no seed has been, I have great faith in a seed. Convince me that you have a seed there, and I am prepared to expect wonders.
Nice.
And he was so gifted at patiently observing the minute goings on of nature, and how he would describe in this beautiful detail how a seed was encapsulated in its shell like a pine cone, you know, and how it dispersed. He was like he did the first studies of dispersal of seeds in Concord. And see, he's the patron saint of localism, because he spent so much time. He walked a half an hour, half of the day.
What do you mean by localism?
That he knew his home Concord and its environs, say a 20 by 20 area, so intimately.
So it's like home rule, like not being dependent somewhere else.
Oh, yeah. So like a local locavore,
but complete the whole complete culture, human culture, local everything, but anyway, so in Walden, his great work. He lived on the pond for 2 years, you know, and he was a very social being actually, and one of these books talks about he had 5 sisters and a mother, mm-hmm. And the love in the family, you know, and but anyways, so in Walden. And this is the crux of Thoreau. He wanted to examine something and lay it bare, whatever it was, so that all the superfluous layers were removed. So you just saw the kernel of truth. And so his goal in going to Walden Pond and living simply away from society was to, in his own words, drive life into a corner.
Mm.
So the analogy is like you drive an animal into a corner, you corner somebody or an animal so they can't get away, a person, and so that he could look all of life. It was just like one. It was all there in front of him, and so he could see if it was awesome and beautiful, or if it was just like trivial and ordinary, and publish it to the world, you know, And
you are listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea with Felicia and Marshall for Kauai's Soapbox, and Jazz with John is coming up at 6 o'clock. And right now we are listening to Andy Sarhanis, and this is the 200th anniversary of celebrating Henry David Thoreau throughout the country. And so also while we're talking about birthdays, we're going to just honor for a moment KKCR's birthday, and know that you are so welcome.
Come help KKCR celebrate 20 years of broadcasting on Kauai. On Saturday, August 19th at Lydgate Park Pavilion, we're having a big pa'ina featuring live music by Michael Keale, Lady Ipo, Shiloh Pa, and Gunga La Gunga. There'll be plenty ono grinds, silent auction, a bouncy house, games, and fun for the whole Ohana. The whole community is invited, and everyone's encouraged to bring a KKCR birthday cake to share. So save the date, Kauai, Saturday, August 19th at Lydgate Park. Ho'oli lahanao, KKCR. See you there.
All right. Come to our birthday party. We love you, and we want you to know that we are a part of one big family, and one of our family members, Andy Sarhanis, is in here. And so how is Henry David Thoreau being celebrated around the world?
Yeah, this is the program for his the bicentennial celebration and
And
workshops, 5 days at the Visitor Center on Walden Pond, a place I've been to. And a 500,000 people visit this place every year.
What I realize is we watch people have things like the 30-meter telescope, the Mauna Kea area in Hawaii, very, very people who are close to the sacredness of the land. For the New England area, Henry David Thoreau is a representation of that, and he has influenced other people, right? I mean, it's not just the Northeast area of the United States that has really looked at that. He's learned in colleges and schools.
Yeah.
And then other leaders, world leaders, have been influenced by him too,
yeah.
Correct?
You know, I highlighted some of the talks, but they're at this event. There's people from India, Taiwan, Japan, England, speaking, Thailand. He was very influential to the king of King Bhumibol, who just died in Thailand. His writings were read by Martin Luther King and Gandhi when they were in jail, and their reading of Thoreau was the number one event that catalyzed them to do what they did, reading Civil Disobedience. You know, and but anyways, for Thoreau is the father of the Back to the Land movement, the environmental ecological movement, and also he was a noted supporter of the abolition of slavery, and he was the first person to speak out in defense publicly of John Brown,
who. The Civil War centered around John Brown, right?
Exactly. He knew that the only way slavery would be ended would by taking up arms. It wasn't going to be done peacefully. So he attacked Harper's Ferry.
There in West Virginia, next to Virginia,
yeah,
Maryland.
It was part of Virginia at that time. But anyway, and then he got captured, he got wounded, two of his sons died, and he got tried, and it was a sensational issue. And people, the abolitionists, were afraid to speak out publicly in his support. But he was the first person to speak out publicly, and the second time at the Tremont Temple in Boston to an audience of 2,500 people. In fact, he was an emergency substitute to Douglas, the black abolitionist.
Frederick Douglass.
Frederick Douglass, who left because he thought his life was in danger over this matter, you know. And people cheered his presentation. You know, he was fearless. You know, he was a person of complete honesty and fearless.
And so,
you know,
when the civil disobedience piece, what is his main message in his book, Civil Disobedience?
Yes, yeah. Well, Civil Disobedience is an essay that was precipitated by the slavery issue and also the Mexican War, which was a highly immoral war, where American soldiers were called upon to slaughter innocent women and children in villages in Mexico. And
that wasn't the War of 1848.
No, it was 1840. It was 1845. It was a real jingoist war, you know.
Is that under James K. Polk? I mean,
yeah.
Because that was Winfield Scott, right? General Winfield Scott. So I'm not sure. I don't remember that part of it that he slaughtered. That was actually part of his win, but maybe it was an earlier win over Texas or something.
No. I read this in history. A large amount of Americans deserted because they refused to do this, and the punishment for desertion is you're shot. You know, so they shot about 100 soldiers.
Marshall, can you look that up? The Mexican American.
Felicia, I wish I could. No, it's not working out.
Because it's what I like to know, like I try and learn, you know, because I've actually read a lot about the War of 1848, which was, this is all a very important time, because that was the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. We hardly ever learn about that.
Yeah.
But that is where the United States took pretty much most of the Western United States.
Right.
They went all the way down to Mexico City. Beat Santa Ana down there, but then traded for this area that was so much further north, you know, and it was part of the Manifest Destiny effort, which went all the way out to Hawaii.
Of course, it was the whole Manifest Destiny, what white superiority, Christian white superiority, you know, and but I did want to read a few selections before. I don't know how much time we have, you know, but
you mentioned desertion. Do you know what's the sentence for treason these days? Do you know?
I don't. Mm-hmm. So you're going to read some to us of his writings, and for the listener who just tuned in, this is Andy Sarhanas reading about Henry David Thoreau, who is the most notable environmentalist in the 1800s and a really critical time of American history, and he was standing up for the Native Americans and for the enslaved people.
Yeah, and a number of things, you know. Mm-hmm. And I have a degree in history, and I consider Thoreau the most profound, sagacious, greatest American of European descent.
What does sagacious mean?
Sagacious, sage-like.
Sage-like, mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And
wise.
Yes, yeah, he's profound. Anyways, I consider him a combination of, he's America's Confucius and Lao Tzu rolled into one.
Really?
Yes.
That's saying a lot.
Yeah, well, I've delved into this man.
Yeah. Boy, he's not quite as well-read. As widely read.
He's immensely read. He is immensely read, Marshall. If you look at some of the things, but this is from a book, The Illustrated World of Thoreau, which came out in the early 1970s, it's called A Temple Called the Body. Every man is the builder of a temple called his body, to the god he worships, after a style purely his own. Nor can he get off by hammering marble instead. We are all sculptors and painters, and our material is our own flesh and blood and bones. Any nobleness begins at once to refine a man's features, any meanness or sensuality to imbrute them. But his aesthetic sense is like it's immense, you know. I mean, he's able to kind of like crystallize a discussion, get right to the meat of it, you know.
You know, it's interesting. I appreciate you bringing it all up because when I have learned about him was in English class in high school, and we really just read him as a poet and an author.
Yeah.
And actually, it's interesting for me because we didn't actually talk about the content of what he had to say. It was more like his style of writing. So, and having grown up in the Western United States, wasn't much focus.
Yeah, you know, I'm a child of the '60s, and before the internet, there was the Whole Earth Catalog, mm-hmm. access to tools, and always in every version of that. It would say about Thoreau's Walden, the prime document for America's third revolution, now in progress. And that's how I feel. Yeah. And this is from The Environmental Imagination by a Harvard professor who is a thorough scholar.
Mm-hmm.
And it deals with a whole slew of American literary and environmental figures, John Muir and a whole slew of them. And anyway, I could note the difference between Muir and Thoreau. And Muir, who came later, he deeply admired Thoreau.
And John Muir was on the West Coast.
Yes.
California.
Yeah, and Muir did not, the native Indians in California, he thought they were sort of detestable, lowly figures.
Who did?
Muir.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, documented in a book I have. Mm. Yeah. But Muir is the poet, the naturalist of the grand and stupendous, like the Grand Canyon, Yosemite. And Thoreau is the person who is focused on the immenseness of nature of its ordinary and near at hand, out your back door.
Right.
And, you know, anyone who is, like, open can gaze into a simple little wildflower right into it and sense this, like, awe, this power so deep and beautiful this is powerful as looking down at the,
Have you thought about doing a talk or a teaching or someplace where people could come and really learn from you more? We're going to have Jazz with John up in just a few minutes in the county council report before that. So we have about another minute.
Another minute, okay. I haven't gotten on track yet.
But, do you want to give out a number or any way for people to contact you? Because you have a lot of passion for this, and it seems like an incredibly important topic, and people might want to go deep with you.
Yeah. Anyway, so the best way to contact me right now is to call my landline. Don't text. Just call 808-828-2039. And
828-2039.
Yeah. And can I read one short quote or two? This is from this book, which I had a spiritual experience with as a young man in 1969. September 28th, this is selections from his journal. Ah, if I could put into words that music which I hear, that music which can bring tears to the eyes of marble statues, to which the very muscles of men are obedient. His writing is so beautiful. A lot of his writing is America's scripture. It's so beautiful and succinct and touching, and this is about the wood thrush, June 22nd, 1853. As I come over the hill, I hear the wood thrush singing his evening lay. This is the only bird whose note affects me like music, affects the flow and tenor of my thoughts, my fancy and imagination. It lifts and exhilarates me. It is a medicative draft to my soul. It is an elixir to my eyes and a fountain of youth to all my senses. It changes all hours to eternal morning. It banishes all trivialness. It reinstates me in my dominion, makes me the lord of creation, is chief musician of my court. This minstrel sings in a time, a heroic age, with which no event in the village can be contemporary. How can they be contemporary when only the latter is temporary at all? So there is something in the music of the cowbell, something sweeter and more nutritious than in the milk which the farmers drink. This thrush's song is a rendezvous to me. I long for wildness, a nature which I cannot put my foot through. Woods where the wood thrush forever sings, where the hours are eternal early morning ones, and there is dew on the grass, and the day is forever unproved. Anyways, All that was ripest and fairest in the wildness and the wild man is preserved and transmitted to us in the strain of the wood thrush. It is the mediator between barbarism and civilization. It is unrepentant as Greece.
John David Thoreau.
Henry.
Henry David Thoreau. I'm so sorry. Henry David Thoreau. I can't believe I just did that. Henry David Thoreau, very beautiful. About 200 years since his life, made a very strong impression on the progression of the environmental movement and the awareness and the transcendental awareness of how God permeates, the divine permeates all of man.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, because it's time for Jazz with John.
Yeah, his relevance only increases with time.
Yes, great example. So this has been Kauai Soapbox. Felicia and Marshall, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, the station that loves you.